This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيما آتاكم إن ربك
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Leaders of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization get together in the Asian Silk Road city of Samarkand to discuss regional and international developments. Hamas calls for Palestinian people to mobilize to protect the Al-Aqsa Mosque from Israeli aggression. Plus, the UN chief warns the prospects for peace in Ukraine are minimal, with no ceasefire in sight. Hello and welcome to World News. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour. The historic Silk Road city of Samarkand in Uzbekistan is hosting leaders of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization for a two-day summit meeting. Chinese President Xi Jinping, Russian leader Vladimir Putin, and Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi will be participating in the event. The main joint session is scheduled for Friday. The SCO is made up of China, Russia, India, Pakistan, and the ex-Soviet Central Asian nations of Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, and Tajikistan. It was set up in 2001. Its members work together to tackle joint security issues, cooperate militarily, and promote trade. The organization accounts for 40% of the world's population and 28% of the global gross domestic product. Iran is in the process of becoming a full member. Iran's foreign minister says the Islamic Republic considers its borders with Armenia as a historical communication route that should be preserved without change. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the remarks during a phone call with his Azeri counterpart, Jehun Bayramov. The top Iranian diplomat exchanged views on the latest developments in the South Caucasian region and expressed concern over the clashes between Yerevan and Baku. He said Iran supports the full territorial integrity of both nations. He called on both sides to remain patient and try to find a diplomatic solution to the problems. Amir Abdullahian said Tehran is ready to mediate such negotiations. Azerbaijan's foreign minister, for his part, said that Baku does not have its eye on any other country's territories. Azerbaijan and Armenia are engaged in yet another deadly border clash. Despite international calls for restraint, casualties have mounted on both sides, even though the reason for the flare-up has been due to the age-old conflict over the Nagorno-Karabakh region. There may be more behind the latest fighting.
The conflict between Azerbaijan and Armenia, after a truce, has blown up again. About 100 soldiers have died in total. This is the worst fighting between the two since the 2020 war. According to Azerbaijan's president, Ilham Aliyev, provocations committed by Armenian forces at the border have been averted and all necessary objectives were fulfilled. It blamed Armenia for the flare-up. It is widely reported that this conflict is due to the dispute over Nagorno-Karabakh region, in which two wars have been fought between the former Soviet republics of Armenia and Azerbaijan. A quick history check reveals how ethnic Armenian separatists in Nagorno-Karabakh first broke away from Azerbaijan when the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991. The war that broke out afterwards claimed the lives of around 30,000 people. Back in 2020, when another war broke out, which lasted 6 weeks, 6,500 lives were lost. The fighting ended with a Russian-brokered ceasefire. Moscow deployed thousands of peacekeepers in the region to successfully mediate to prevent the war from continuing. The question is, what is behind the most recent flare-up?
Azerbaijan's military operations have different goals which also impact the interests of Iran, which has close ties with both Baku and Yerevan. For starters, Azerbaijan has geopolitically aligned itself with the West as well as Israel and Turkey. On the other hand, its aim is to separate Nakhchivan, its autonomous area which connects Iran to Armenia. Iran is against any such plan and has said that it would not accept any border changes between the two countries.
Azerbaijan needs access to bodies of water in order to provide energy resources to the West, which, given its relationship with Iran, Israel and Western entities would prevent that from happening. Azerbaijan's last 2 years of military action against Armenia is to cut and separate the land route between Iran and Armenia and the direct access to Nakhchivan from the southern area of Siunak or Zangezur Corridor, a concept for a transport corridor which, if implemented, would give Azerbaijan unimpeded access to Nakhchivan. Meanwhile, Israel, the U.S., Russia, and Turkey do have a hand either directly or indirectly in this conflict, all for their own political objectives. Israel is a supporter of Azerbaijan, and as such has strengthened its relationship, especially when it comes to military equipment like drones. This to have a front against Iran. Meanwhile, Iran has always had a diplomatic approach to the conflict. During the past war, it was very telling what Iran said, that renewed fighting between its neighbors, Azerbaijan and Armenia, could escalate into a wider regional war. And this is where the U.S. may have motives behind seeing a renewed conflict. One intention may be to draw Russia into this war in order to weaken its capabilities in the Ukraine conflict. And the U.S. certainly does not mind if Iran's borders are destabilized, leaving that task to its watchdog in the region, namely Israel. The U.S., however, is presenting another side to this provocation. The U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has said that Russia may have a hand in this conflict, stirring the pot in order to distract from Russia's most recent losses in Ukraine, according to the U.S. point of view.
Hamas is inviting the Palestinian people to mobilize to defend the Al-Aqsa Mosque against Israeli plots. The resistance movement says the residents of Al-Quds are at the forefront of the campaign against the occupying regime and that Palestinians are pinning their hopes on them to safeguard the Holy Mosque. Reports suggest that Israeli military forces and settlers are planning to launch a large-scale raid on Al-Aqsa Mosque in the coming week to mark religious holidays of the Jews. Radical groups are encouraging the settlers to storm the mosque at the beginning of the Jewish New Year in late September. Settlers backed by Israeli troops frequently raid the mosque in a move that Palestinians view as a desecration of their sanctities. People have attended a conference in Gaza to condemn the Oslo Peace Accords signed in 1993. Palestinians consider the accords as a major setback and even worse than the Balfour Declaration of 1917, which helped create the Israeli regime on occupied Palestinian land. Ashraf Shannon brings us more details in the following report.
Palestinians have held a national conference to mark 29 years since the signing of the Oslo Accords. Hundreds of people attended the conference, demanding the cancellation of the agreements. In September 1993, the Palestine Liberation Organization, PLO, signed the Oslo Accords with the Israeli regime on the lawn of the White House in Washington, D.C. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas asserted the failure of the Oslo Accords and called on the Palestinian Authority to withdraw its recognition of the Israeli regime.
As we mark the 29th anniversary of the ill-fated Oslo Accords, we call upon the Palestinian Authority to withdraw from the Oslo Accords and to cancel its recognition of the Israeli regime. Today, we also salute the Palestinian resistance, who managed to liberate the Gaza Strip in 2005. Armed resistance is the key to the liberation of all of Palestine.
The Oslo Accords were meant to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, but nearly three decades later, Palestinians consider them as a bad chapter in their history. Attendees slammed the Oslo Accords and expressed their support to resistance against the Israeli regime.
The Zionist enemy will never respect any peace agreements and only understands the language of force. We're here to support armed resistance against the Zionist enemy.
Senior officials attending the conference called on all Palestinians to unite their ranks and adhere to armed resistance against the Israeli occupation.
The Oslo Accords were a stab in the back of the Palestinian people. The Zionist regime is a cancer in the region and it must be removed. All forms of resistance must be used against Zionist forces, and armed resistance is the key to defeat the Zionist occupation.
Observers say the Oslo Accords have only brought calamities to Palestinians and have failed to secure the creation of an independent Palestinian state.
29 years on, Palestinians say that peace accords will not free their land, and it's only armed resistance which will help them regain their rights. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Israeli deadly night raids against the city of Jenin in the occupied West Bank continue. A young Palestinian identified as Odey Salah was killed by Israeli gunfire when the military stormed his neighborhood in western Jenin overnight. He was only 15 years old. Also, another young man was wounded. The raid comes a day after two Palestinians lost their lives during an ambush against an Israeli military checkpoint near Jenin that also left an Israeli soldier dead. Israel uses routine night raids across the occupied West Bank, Jenin in particular, as a tactic to scare Palestinian residents. Dozens have been killed during these attacks this year. Facing decades of poverty and violence, Jenin has become a focal point of resistance against the Israeli occupation. Earlier, we talked to Mona Kandil to shed more light on the recent clashes between Israeli forces and Palestinians. Let's take a listen.
And they stormed the houses of two Palestinians, carried out an anti-Israel operation yesterday at the Israeli military checkpoint of Al-Jarali in Jenin. During this raid, clashes took place between Israeli forces and Palestinians, residents of the Kfar Dan village. Palestinian paramedics revealed that 15-year-old Odey Salah was seriously wounded and transferred to hospital. Then they declared that he succumbed to his injuries. We are speaking about another Palestinian was wounded during this operation. At least one Palestinian was wounded also, and he's a relative of this, of one of the Palestinian martyrs who had been killed by the Israeli soldiers yesterday. We have to mention that during the operation, or the anti-Israel operation to be specific, that was carried out yesterday at the Al-Janami military checkpoint, this had led to the killing of an Israeli soldier or an Israeli military official.
Moving on to the conflict in Ukraine, the Secretary General of the UN warns that the prospects for peace in Ukraine are, quote, minimal, adding that even a ceasefire is not in sight. Antonio Guterres issued the warning following a phone conversation with Russian President Vladimir Putin. Guterres said it would be naive to believe there has been sufficient progress towards a rapid end to the war in Ukraine. The UN chief added that he was maintaining contact with both sides. He expressed hope that one day it would be possible to go to a higher level of discussion. The Russia-Ukraine war started in late February. Moscow says the war in Ukraine will end once Kiev meets its demands, including never applying to join NATO. Thousands of people have lost their lives as a result of the war in Ukraine, while millions have been displaced. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says Russian forces have suffered a big loss after Kiev forces rapidly advanced in the Kharkiv region.
During the first day of the Ukrainian offensive in Kharkiv region, our troops advanced 19 kilometers ahead and 110 kilometers in 5 days of combat. Almost 400 settlements were recaptured in total. 150,000 Ukrainians who remained on this territory now feel again how it is to live a normal, safe life.
Ukraine has managed to force Russia to retreat from the city of Izyum and swathes of land in the east. It has also made headway in the northeastern Kharkiv region that borders Russia. Moscow has confirmed that the drawdown from Kharkiv, but says its troops are regrouping 7 months into the war. The Kremlin insists that it will achieve its military goals. As King Charles III takes up the reins of power as the British sovereign, questions are growing about the future of the monarchy. The king is also faced with challenges such as calls for independence in the remaining Commonwealth nations, where the British monarch is still head of state. Saipur Reza reports from London.
King Charles III, proclaimed after 73 years. His life is a complicated story. From his hatred of school as a child, to his high-profile marriage to and divorce from his former wife, Princess Diana, to his affair with his now wife and queen consort, Kamala Parks Owens. Those who believe in him say he put his time to good use, that he'll do well in his role as the monarch. Others say the king is faced with huge challenges. At home, he's facing growing anti-monarchy sentiment as the country grapples with the worst cost of living crisis in decades. Calls from Republicans who say the monarchy is classist, expensive, and outdated.
Are we really now in a place in 21st century Britain where a new head of state is proclaimed, we're told to accept this person without any question?
There's also his relationship with the devolved nations, such as Northern Ireland, with whom the monarchy has had a complicated history, not forgotten by those who bore the brunt of it.
There will never be an acceptance of the monarchy here in Ireland. There's been too much history, too much has been done in the name of the monarchy in Ireland for the Irish people to ever be conscious of that ever happening again.
In Scotland, where the Queen died, independence remains at the center of political debate. The death of Queen Elizabeth II has also revived the debate about the future and unity of the British Commonwealth, a group of 15 independent countries that recognize the British monarch as their head of state.
We've already seen many calls across the Commonwealth for the removal of those particular countries to be removed from the Commonwealth. I think that's going to that's going to be something that is going to be at the top of the agenda over the next couple of years.
Constitutionally, the monarch should be seen and not heard from on contentious issues. King Charles is known to not shy away from expressing his views on a range of topics, such as the environment, new laws, and more. He says he won't do it as sovereign. His critics see it differently.
The new king starts his job in different circumstances than his mother did. An increasing number of Britons are questioning the privileged position of the royal family. The Commonwealth looks set to unravel, and the union of the United Kingdom looks uncertain. Will King Charles III be the last UK monarch? Saipur is up, London.
Well, those were the top stories for this hour. Thank you.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
application on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Arbaeen March, the story of love. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Arbaeen means 40 in Arabic, but today it is known as the 40th day after the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, peace upon him, in the year 61 AH. This day owes its importance and significance to some historical accounts which say that the survivors of the tragedy of Ashura returned to Karbala on this day and visited the graves of Imam Hussein, Hazrat Abbas, and other martyrs to revive their pledge of allegiance with them and keep their goal and ideal alive. Every year, a few weeks before Arbaeen, people start their journey on foot toward the holy shrine of Imam Hussein from southernmost regions of Iraq. Moreover, Muslims from Iran and other Muslim countries also get prepared to participate in this indescribable journey of love. Every year, the number of pilgrims and lovers increases, and people from all walks of life gather together and march shoulder to shoulder toward the Kaaba of love. Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, says on the Arba'in March, "The combination of love with faith and intellect with emotion is among the unique characteristics of the school of the Ahlul Bayt, peace upon them, and the loving and faithful move of the people of different countries in this unprecedented phenomenon is undoubtedly among the divine sacraments. Tens of millions of people converge in this glorious gathering to announce their love and obedience to the Ahlul Bayt of Prophet of Islam. For sure, great ulema and sources of emulation have played an important role in promotion of Arba'in March. Late source of emulation, Grand Ayatollah Muhammad Taqi Bahjat said, "It has been narrated that when the Imam of the age, Imam Mahdi, re-emerges, he introduces himself to the world through Imam Hussein, peace upon him. Thus, at that time, all world people should have known Hussein, peace upon him. But all world people do not know Hussein yet, and this is our shortcoming, as we have not shouted in a way that the world hears our voice. The Arba'in March is the best opportunity to introduce Hussein, peace upon him, to the world." Mirza Jawad Maliki Tabrizi, one of the greatest ulema of the last century, also has said, "It is necessary for the devoted faithful to consider Arba'in as his day of grief and mourning and try to visit the martyred Imam at his tomb, even if it happens once in his whole life. It is because the noble hadith mentions 5 things for a faithful: 51 rak'at prayer during day and night, ziyarat arba'in, wearing a ring on the right hand, prostrating on soil and uttering Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim loudly in prayers." Imam Musa Sadr was the leader of the Lebanese Shia Muslims who was abducted by the agents of the Zionist regime and the former Libyan ruler Muammar Gaddafi in 1978. In his youth, when he was in Najaf, he used to march from Najaf to Karbala for Arba'in. During his journey, he used to recite supplications and ziyarats, or a standard form of salutation to Imam Hussein, with tears in his eyes. As it has been said several times, Imam Hussein does not belong to Shia or even Muslims. He belongs to mankind. These days, one can see and hear this phrase frequently: "Hubbul Hussein yajma'una," meaning Hussein's love brings us together, or simply "Al Hussein yajma'una" means Hussein brings us together. Yes, Hussein is the center of unity and convergence of scores of millions of pure hearts from all over the world. Sheikh A'la is a Christian professor of Baghdad University who has devoted himself to the service of the pilgrims of Imam Hussein. The 7-year-old man says that he has come to the mokeb of a friend to serve pilgrims. He is at Isa ibn Maryam mokeb. He says that Imam Hussein endured many calamities which resembled those of Prophet Jesus. He says, "We are beside the lovers of Imam Hussein, peace upon him. Imam Hussein does not belong only to Shia or Sunni Muslims, but he belongs to all free-spirited people of the world. That's why today people from different strata, whether Muslim or Christian, have converged in this huge gathering." Alexander Dugin is a Russian writer and a strategist who had once taken part in Arbain March from Najaf to Karbala. He describes this magnanimous phenomenon. In my opinion, the Arbain March, which has found global dimensions on a daily basis, and people from every nationality and religion, including Christians, participate in it, is an introduction to a fundamental development on the world. I have this several times, that the modern world, with its liberalist and capitalist ideology, has come to an end, and it has no achievement for mankind except causing crisis. And human being today needs a spiritual and divine resurrection whose grounds strongly exist in the Islamic Revolution and the uprising of Imam Khomeini. This Russian writer likens the Arbain March to an apocalyptic move, saying, "This march is an important sign of preparation for a global and apocalyptic spiritual development. I, as an Orthodox Christian, agree with the apocalyptic approach of the Islamic Revolution and hope that this grand event, which the followers of all religions wait for, won't be much far. The Arbain March is more like an apocalyptic event rather than ordinary and usual one. We and all those who seek justice and spirituality in the dark and bleak modern world should unite together, as this march is a manifestation of unity."
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Spiritual guidance for millions across the world.
Part 1. actually what we see is a manifestation of the human spirit, a yearning for justice.
Hussein, the grandson of the Prophet of Islam, was brutally murdered along with members of his family. This was simply for his objection to the unscrupulous and unethical kingdom of Yazid.
I have a lot of sadness to think that he was the Prophet's grandson and that he was murdered by the caliph of his time, and that it was a senseless death in its way.
And why is the anniversary of his death, Ashura, commemorated throughout the world, even reaching Britain?
Why did Hussein stand and offered his blood? Was it just because he wanted to be killed? Or there was a message?
We go from a prophet, we go from Ali, who suffered himself a death at the hand of an assassin, and then we move to the next stage, which is the martyrdom of a prophet's grandson. And so there is a kind of thread, spiritual threads, which connects them all up. And it's a thread which tells us about the fate of a righteous person, a fate of a righteous man.
He knew that he was going to get killed. On the night of Ashura, he told his companions that tomorrow all of us are going to be killed. So anyone who wants to leave, let him leave. He wanted this message to get through to the history that, look, when my grandfather talked about Islam, he did not talk about empire. He did not talk about the Green Palace of Damascus. He did not talk about armies. He did not talk about conquests. What he was concerned about was the spiritual life of Muslims.
It was these principles of Prophet Muhammad that were a source of great inspiration for Hussein. As a child, he looked up to his grandfather as the perfect role model. The Prophet loved Hussein dearly.
We know that Hussein, as well as his brother Hassan, were much loved by the Prophet. And he had them on his knee and played with them. So it's quite a movie. Anybody who's been a father or a grandfather know how lovely that is. Imam Hussein was not just, an ordinary man. He was a Prophet's grandson. And he was beloved Prophet. And indeed, Ali, the Lion of Islam, and the fourth Khalifa.
In fact, Hussein was loved throughout the entire region. During his life, Imam Hussein very quickly became prominent for his drive to help the poor and enrich the lives of orphans, activities for which his father, Imam Ali, had been renowned. For Hussein to have had someone like Imam Ali as a father was a distinct advantage.
He was a strong advocate of human rights. And he had problems with people engaging in high society gatherings where the poor would be ignored.
In fact, this line of the Prophet's family remains to this day a source of spiritual guidance for millions across the world.
They were strong believers in God because they were strong believers in justice. They were strong believers in humanity. They're strong believers against oppression.
Their principles are studied to this day. Being part of this family, Hussein was well known for his exemplary morals. In fact, he is often compared to Jesus Christ, also a key figure in Islam.
What kind of a conversation would take place in between Jesus, Imam Hussein alayhi salam, or Moses if they were in a room together today? All these personalities were the same light. They were the same light giving us the message of humanity. And they cannot be restricted to one faith or one faction, but they belong to the whole world.
Jesus had very great concern for the poor, widows and orphans. Those are all things that I've heard about from the life of Imam Hussein. And he would highlight their experience. So they would have had a lot in common to talk about in how the people at the bottom of society should be raised up to the top so that society was focused on caring for them. And one of the famous sayings of Jesus is, the first shall be last and the last shall be first. I'm not familiar with all the sayings of Imam Hussein, but I can imagine that he would have said something very similar, and they would have had a lot of similarities talking to each other.
Interestingly, this expression by Jesus reverberates in the Quran. As Hussein would talk amongst his followers, he would have recited this verse about being accountable on the Day of Judgment, that some will be lowered and others will be raised.
That is the last message that Imam Hussein alayhi salam gave to us, to speak against oppression, to speak against tyranny, to speak for the poor, to speak for the oppressed, to raise our voices, to help them.
The role of Imam Hussein mainly, principally, was to observe and enforce the enjoining what is good and forbidding what is evil. And he was one man who would not bow down before the despotic and tyrant ruler like Yazid.
But who was Yazid? Quite simply, he was a tyrant, the repressive leader of a brutal regime. He had just been appointed by his father, Muawiyah, to rule over the Muslim world. This appointment would have a devastating effect on the history of Islam.
This was a point of no return. Should Islam or the leadership of Islam been kept in the hand of someone like Yazid, we would have now completely a different understanding of Islam. Perhaps we won't have Islam.
He was corrupt in the sense that he would allow mismanagement of the public affairs to be a norm. So it was a total corruption of the right and a total embracing of that which is anti-humanitarian, if you want to put it in those terms.
The Holy Quran considers justice to be the yardstick by which all merits should be measured. Essentially, how can you have peace of mind or peace in society when injustice boasts before your very eyes?
The life that Imam Hussein alayhi salam lives, it actually shouts opposition. He doesn't have to say anything, just the sheer lifestyle he lives, the sunnah he enacts, is a direct opposition to the lifestyle, to the worldview of the Umayyad dynasty. So Imam Hussein alayhi salam was proactive. He brought the war to Yazid.
Yazid knew that Imam Hussein rejected his leadership. This agitated him. He was also aware of people's hidden love for Hussein.
I think Yazid wanted, by obtaining the legitimacy of Imam Hussein, want to be confirmed in his own authority, and if he did not feel confident that he was, and he must have been aware also of the degree of popular support that Imam on his side. So it was an attempt to acquire legitimacy, and it was not a legitimacy which was merely, it was not just support of a particular faction, but it was a faction which was a prophet's line. And we know actually even successive caliphs try to get the successors of Imam Hussein on their side.
Yazid knew that he had two choices, either to obtain Imam Hussein's allegiance or to kill him. Either way, Hussein knew that he would not be safe to remain where he was living. Just as his grandfather, Prophet Muhammad, all those years ago fled Mecca to Medina, Hussein was now leaving Medina to Mecca. Accompanying him were a small group of close relatives and loyal companions. Whilst Hussein was in Mecca, a movement had begun in a city called Kufa. They had heard of Hussein's refusal to pledge allegiance to Yazid and were gathering support to write letters requesting Hussein to take over leadership in their city.
It is recorded in the history that 18,000 people wrote letters to Hussein. As in some of those letters, we read, فَعَجَّلْ ثُمَّ عَجَّلْ hurry and hurry, we are waiting for you.
The tragedy was that even in the sanctuary of Mecca, Hussein, the beloved grandson of the Prophet, was not safe. He was in danger, a conspiracy to kill him at the hands of the same people who claimed that they were followers of his grandfather.
I think this is one of those most tragic things, that someone like Hussein, peace be on him, had no other choice. He was left in among the Ummah, having no choice, no place to go. And he said, okay, they have told me that they would support me. I go to them and talk to them. And he continued moving.
Imam Hussein had actually sent an envoy to Kufa, his trusted cousin, Muslim ibn Aqil. This was to see if the people of Kufa really were committed to the pledge in their letters. On the other hand, Yazid became aware of the atmosphere in Kufa. In response, Yazid sent someone there to repress the uprising. This man was Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad.
In a matter of days, he changed the whole atmosphere of Kufa by threatening, by giving promise of wealth, by giving position to people. Suddenly, the whole ambience of Kufa was changed, which is very, very shameful, of course. A Muslim doing something like this for the promise of worldly issues.
Yazid's plan to quell the uprising in Kufa was successful. Imam Hussein's cousin was killed. On the way to Kufa, Hussein met a young man named Farazdak, who later became a famous Arab poet. He gave Hussein devastating news about the changes in Kufa and warned him against entering the city.
He said, "Qulubu an-nas ma'ak wa asyafuhum wa suyufuhum 'alayk." The heart of the people are with you, but their swords are against you because they have sold the swords to Banu Umayyah, to Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad. So you are actually entering a city where people like you, but they are going to meet you with their swords.
Imam Hussein gathered his followers to tell them that the people of Kufa had turned against them.
And our followers, those who sent letters to us, have betrayed us. I just want you to be aware of this, where you are moving to.
In Kufa, Ubaydullah enforced a police state. No one was to enter or exit the city. It was a scary time.
At that time, a man came from Hamdan, a tribe in Yemen, for some business. He came to Kufa for some business, and he was caught, and he was arrested. And he said, "I didn't know. I have come just for business." And Ubaydullah thought that this is the best man to kill because he has no tribe here. We kill him to make an example out of him for others, that anyone capable of taking sword, remaining in Kufa, will be killed. And they killed the poor man, who was quite unaware of what was happening at all.
The army that Ubaydullah had sent was headed by Huwar, a military commander. His orders were simple: to capture Hussein and bring him to Kufa. Imam Hussein saw the army from a distance and waited.
Now, the beautiful thing is that Hussein had actually taken lots of water from the previous station. The first thing which appeared to Hussein, peace be on him, was that they were very thirsty. They had rushed. It was middle of the day. They had rushed. Some of them were on food. Some of them were on camels, on horses. And without asking them, "Why are you here? Are you enemies or are you friends?" he told his companions, "Bring the waters and let them drink. And also let the horses and camels drink."
This is abiding by the rules of war. He was abiding by, you know, the humanitarian values that are meant to be maintained when, you know, a Muslim is in the state of war. So offering water to those who are on the other side, Imam Hussein was always thinking about people as a whole, their destiny. He was always concerned for them.
This was the beautiful thing about it. The sad thing about it was that the first thing Hussein asked her is that, "Have you come to fight or have you come to support?" He said, "We have come to fight." And Hussein said, La hawla wa la quwwata illa billah. There's no power but the power of Allah.
Huwar wanted to arrest Hussein and take him to the Umayyads, but Hussein resisted. The interesting point was that because Huwar respected Hussein and didn't want a confrontation with him, he agreed to let him move in a direction away from Mecca until he received new orders from Ubaydullah. A while later, Huwar received this new order, and the order was to force Hussein and his followers to stop and remain where they were. By that time, they had reached one of the most hostile deserts in the region.
When things came to this point, Hussein, peace be on him, asked his companions, what is the name of this place? People, of course, some of his companions were very familiar with the area. And they said, this is Nainawa. And he said, is there any other name? One of them said, this is Ghazariya. And he said, any other name? And one of them said, this special desert is called Karbala. And then Hussein said, Ardu Karban Wabala. This is distress and calamity and agony.
To add to the brutality, the now 30,000 strong army blocked the route to the nearby Euphrates River. This was so that Hussein and his followers would not have access to water.
And that is why the thirst was added to all that agony which was going on. And this actually made the Karbala the whole more tragic incident, that they not only killed the grandson of the Prophet, they killed him while he was thirsty, while his family were thirsty.
A particular detail which lingers in my memory is a terrible thirst, which Imam Hussein suffered during the siege. Karbala was actually quite protracted. You know, many people imagine it just one go, but in fact, far more drawn out. So in a way, it conveys in a certain very dramatic way the extent of the suffering.
But the suffering would not end here. Hussein and his followers were cornered, with no routes for escaping. But they would not back down now. Hussein and his followers were ready to stand. With all the respect that Hussein had gathered through his life, why were people ready to kill him?
The Emir of Medina, a commander of the army, everyone, they respected Hussein. They knew that Hussein is not the type of man that they can put up a fight against. However, I don't know, in the heat of that situation, what happened, that people were somehow deceived. استحوذ عليهم الشيطان فأنساهم ذكر الله, as we have in the Quran. Shaitan suddenly overcame them and they forgot ذكر الله, and they forgot the people who were the people of Allah.
And in that treacherous heat of deception, the troops who had claimed to be Muslims were about to manifest an ugly face of brutality against the Prophet's grandson.
It was not something that was unexpected. They all knew, even the women and children in that camp knew, that the enemy was not only ready to fight, they were ready to kill.
Whereas Imam Hussein had to do the ultimate sacrifice, and he wasn't a submissive person. He wasn't a lamb going to the slaughter. There was no instance of going there just for the sake of being killed. Imam Hussein, in fact, we know as a fact, he fought up to the last drop of his blood.
And Hussein was not only to sacrifice his life, but he was to sacrifice whatever he had and all those who were dearest to him.
There's no way you should compromise with injustice. And that's the example. It's the example with practically all the imams and certainly all the prophets. They displayed this courage. It's the inspiration that he gave everybody and still does today. It's pretty clear. And so it's a benchmark. He represents the ultimate sacrifice.
He would provide hope to all the oppressed today. And he would illustrate that numbers mean nothing if you're in the right. He would just mean hope. Numerical majority doesn't count when it comes to right and wrong.
Having the benefit of retrospect, we see how right Hussein was. I mean, he set the example in history. That is, there is no doubt about it. That is magnificent. The example that Hussein set in the history, I think he did something that his grandfather, the Prophet, peace be on him, expected from him to do, to somehow setting the standard against someone like Yazid.
Over 1,300 years have passed since this event, but Imam Hussein's brutal death is still commemorated. The day is known as Ashura, and remembering its message has spread across the world, including Britain. Why?
In the limelight. Recent reports in scientific journals have shown that breathing polluted air in the European continent has reduced people's lives. Also, these reports have announced the premature death of about 1.3 million people in Europe. That is about 25% of the annual death of this continent is due to air pollution and cancer. Air pollution causes the increase of underlying diseases and cardiovascular problems, and based on new research conducted, air pollution is directly related to lung and also to other cancers. Pollution is reportedly linked to 10% of cancer cases in Europe. The main cause of air pollution in big cities is industry and factories, which play a big role in polluting the air by producing methane, carbon dioxide, fuel oil, and other polluting gases. Smoke and toxic substances produced by cars and vehicles also play an important role in air pollution in big cities. Concerning this issue, we have taken a look at some of the world's media. Please stay with us. The website of the European Environment Agency writes, according to a new report, pollutants in the environment and at the workplace, as well as some natural risks, have a huge impact on our health and in some cases lead to cancer. With nearly 3 million new patients and 1.3 million deaths each year across the European Union, cancer takes a huge toll on this society. The economic costs are also enormous, estimated at around 178 billion euros in 2018 alone. According to the European Environment Agency's study, most of these environmental and occupational cancer risks can be reduced by preventing pollution and changing behaviours. Reducing exposure to these risks offers an effective and cost-effective way of reducing cancer cases and associated deaths. For the first time, the European Environment Agency investigated the links between cancer and the environment, reviewing the latest scientific evidence on air pollution, radon, ultraviolet radiation, secondhand smoke and chemicals. The report estimates that environmental and occupational risks lie behind around 10% of cancer cases in Europe. Virginijus Sinkevičius, the European Union Commissioner for the Environment, Fisheries and Oceans, says, "The European Environment Agency report highlights that too many cancer cases have an underlying environmental cause." Stella Kyriakides, the EU Commissioner for Health and Food Safety, says, "Every year in Europe, an estimated over 250,000 lives are lost to environmental-related cancer." The findings of the European Environment Agency show very clearly how the health of our planet and the health of our citizens are closely interlinked. We need to work with nature, not against it. The British daily The Guardian sheds more light on this issue. The Guardian reports, scientists have uncovered how air pollution causes lung cancer in groundbreaking research that promises to rewrite our understanding of the disease. The findings outline how fine particulates contained in car fumes awaken dormant mutations in lung cells and tip them into a cancerous state. The work helps explain why so many non-smokers develop lung cancer and is a wake-up call about the damaging impact of pollution on human health. Professor Charles Swanton of the Francis Crick Institute